versus Nevarez versus U.S.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. This appeal comes from the District Court's denial of Mr. Narvaez's petition for relief under Section 2255. At sentencing, Narvaez was treated as a career offender based on, or under Section 4B1 of the Federal Sentencing Guidelines, based on two prior convictions for failure to report escapes. Subsequently, the Supreme Court, through its decisions in Begay and Chambers, announced that failure to report escapes are not violent crimes for purposes of the career offender enhancement. Consequently, Narvaez is now serving about an additional 5 years on his sentence, even though he is not and never has been a career offender. We've covered a number of issues in the briefs, but unless the Court has any other topics they'd like to discuss, I'd like to focus the majority of my argument today on Narvaez's non-constitutional miscarriage of justice claim. As I indicated, the miscarriage of justice claim here arises because Narvaez improperly received the improper career offender enhancement. He's serving a longer sentence than otherwise could have been imposed under the law. Courts have recognized that where you have a complete miscarriage of justice, non-constitutional guidelines claims are cognizable under Section 2255. In Johnson, for example, the Supreme Court, in a case very similar to this one, recognized that a non-constitutional guidelines claim was cognizable under Section 2255. In that case, the petitioner sought to challenge the application of the career offender enhancement because the underlying prior convictions were no longer applicable. And in that case, the priors were no longer applicable because after he was sentenced, they were vacated in a state court proceeding. And here, of course, you have Supreme Court's retroactive decisions in McGahn Chambers indicating that the priors are no longer crimes of violence. But we don't think that that distinction should make any difference in this case.
Wasn't that decision actually made on timeliness grounds in Johnson?
Ultimately, yes. I mean, the court basically looked past the underlying 225, whether it was cognizable at all under 2255, and then the question was whether the petitioner was diligent pursuing the state court claims and seeking vacatur of those.
Right. So was there actually a holding that these sorts of claims are cognizable for 2255 purposes?
No, in Johnson, that would be dicta.
Persuasive dicta.
Persuasive dicta. So the distinction here is the vacator versus Begay and Chambers being retroactively applicable. But we do have cases that, including Supreme Court, again, in Davis, and this court in Young, recognizing that you can have a complete miscarriage of justice where there's a post-conviction change of law such that the underlying offense is no longer criminal. And we acknowledge here that his conviction was for bank robbery, and we recognize that Begay and Chambers don't go to the offense of bank robbery, but he's also being punished for being a career offender. And because...
How much more time did he get than he would have, if it had been sentenced the way you would have preferred him to be sentenced, how much more time did he get under this scheme?
Anywhere between 4 and 6 years. It's interesting if you look at the record at sentencing, taking all the circumstances into consideration. The sentencing judge there thought that the appropriate sentence should be in the midpoint of the sentencing range. So in that sense, the selection of the proper range becomes critical in this case. And had the judge imposed the appropriate range, the midpoint sentence would have been 5 years less because it would have been 170 months versus, say, 112 or 113
talking
months.
Roughly maybe 5 years more than he would have gotten out of it.
Exactly. And again, I think an important fact here is when he was sentenced, when Narvaez was sentenced, was before the Supreme Court's decision in Booker. So at the time, the court recognized that the guidelines themselves had the force and effect of laws. Now, the government will argue that regardless of whether the guidelines had the force and effect of laws at the time Narvaez was sentenced, that because the guidelines are now advisory, that Narvaez can't show a complete miscarriage of justice. But we disagree with this. And I think that one of the problems is that that type of reasoning, looking at what the sentencing court might do, is precisely the type of reasoning that troubled the Supreme Court in Hicks and what the Supreme Court in that case labeled a frail conjecture. The defect here and the miscarriage of justice occurred when he was originally sentenced, and the Supreme Court's intervening decision in Booker does nothing to right that injustice. And furthermore, it's not as though if this court goes back for resentencing, the court's going to be able to just rubber stamp the original sentence. They're going to have to, at least as a starting point, look at what the applicable range is, and then from that point intelligently craft an individualized sentence for Narvaez. The government is also arguing that there can't be a complete miscarriage of justice in this case because the sentence does not exceed the applicable statutory maximum, but again, we disagree. Whether a sentence exceeds the statutory maximum is just one of the bases for relief under 2255, and indeed this court has distilled the several bases for relief under 2255 into three categories: violations that are, or defects that are constitutional, jurisdictional, or that result in a complete miscarriage of justice. So whether a sentence exceeds the applicable statutory maximum is just one type of miscarriage of justice that can fall within that last category. Again, we're relying on the different type where you have the post-conviction change of law. In adopting an approach that the government would suggest, the result of that would be that you would never have a miscarriage of justice in a sentencing guidelines case because the sentence always is going to fall within the applicable statutory maximum. And to that end, we think that the government's approach is also inconsistent with cases like this court's decision in Scott that left the door open for guidelines claims where you have a miscarriage of justice.
Although the opinion in Scott did say that, generally speaking, guidelines mistakes don't fall into the miscarriage of justice category.
And I think that's true. Generally, that's going to be the case. It's only going to be the rare circumstances that we have here where, I mean, this is a very rare circumstance where you have an intervening Supreme Court decision that's retroactively applicable that goes against what had been clear circuit precedent. So,
well, the miscalculation in Scott had to do with what, criminal history scoring?
It was criminal history scoring.
It wasn't a career offender case?
That's right. And it was the type of, it was which criminal history category he should have fallen in.
Okay.
So as the court recognized, it was the type of challenge that should have been brought in direct appeal.
All right. It didn't involve definitionally the same sort of thing that we've got here, which is which predicate offenses qualify as violent felonies.
That's right,
crimes of violence.
So with that, unless the court has any additional questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Director.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Good morning. Michael Rotker from the Department of Justice on behalf of the United States. I'd like to actually begin and point out the distinction. I think my adversaries, the way he structured the issues by starting with the non-constitutional guidelines claim, I think there are a number of procedural impediments before we can get to that point. And I think analytically and logically, the starting point has to be whether or not the certificate of appealability in this case was validly and properly issued. And if once we decide on the certificate issue, then we can get to whether or not there is a constitutional claim. But to start with a non-constitutional claim, I think, puts the cart a little bit before the horse. In our view, Narvaez is not entitled to collateral relief on his guidelines misapplication claim. But again, the certificate of appealability never should have been granted in the first place. Now, prior to 1996, federal prisoners could appeal as of right from the denial of a Section 2255 motion. State prisoners, however, had to make a substantial showing of the denial of a federal right. Now, in 1996, with the enactment of the AEDPA, Congress, in an effort to strengthen the finality of criminal judgments, made three significant revisions to the law regarding post-conviction appeals. First, it extended the substantial showing requirement to federal prisoners for the first time. Second, it made clear that courts have an affirmative duty to specify the issues for appeal in the four corners of the certificate itself. And third, and I think perhaps most relevant here, is that Congress retreated from the prior federal right standard and said that a certificate may only issue upon a substantial showing of a denial of a constitutional right. And that's the key word. The retrenchment, or the narrowing, if you will, from a federal right to a constitutional right, I think is what's significant, because in this case, the argument that we can start with a non-constitutional claim is effectively ignoring the limitations imposed by the COA statute. Now, in this case, the clarified certificate that...
Except the COA statute doesn't limit the scope of the 2255 remedy once the petitioner's in the door on appeal, right?
It doesn't limit the remedy, but what Congress is doing, I think, is a two-step process. The first step is a screening mechanism, if you will.
Right.
And they're saying that only constitutional issues can justify the taking of an appeal from the denial of a 2255 motion. Now, if there is a substantial constitutional question
Right. And
relief is forthcoming, then the remedial issues, I think, are down the line. But
well,
we're talking about the threshold question here of whether or not there is a I'm sorry.
But the scope of review is not limited to that substantial constitutional issue in the COA. There can be, you know, issues of law that are of non-constitutional dimension. Now, that's the whole point of the other aspects of 2255.
In the district court, I agree completely. In other words, there's a dichotomy here. There's lots of dichotomies, but the one I think Your Honor is pointing out is that in the district court, you can certainly raise constitutional, statutory, non-constitutional, I think even treaty claims. You can raise a whole panoply of claims.
Right.
But we're fuddling it now. And if the 2255 is denied, whatever the claim that was raised, the appeal can only be taken if there is a substantial showing of the denial of a constitutional right. And I don't believe there's any authority for the proposition that you can bring along non-constitutional claims as well. In other words,
what
I think you're limited.
What authority is there that says you can't? Once you have the predicate substantial constitutional issue.
I want to retreat from something I just said. There is authority that says you can, but I'd like to talk about that in a moment. It's the court's recent decision in Welch, which does say that you can do it, but I want to comment on that in a second. But to answer your question, the authority that I think says that you can't is the COA statute itself. And this court's cases, the Young decision, I think from 19, there are several Young decisions, but I believe the one from 1997 talks about the dichotomy between what can be raised in the district court and what can then be raised on appeal. Now, that's not to say, for example, in the post-Bailey cases, it's not to say that a statutory claim that's denied in the district court cannot be raised in the Court of Appeals, because a Bailey claim, as this court concluded, has a constitutional dimension to it that can support the issuance of a COA. That's the same argument that I think Mr. Narvaez, the analogy, is trying to make in this case. And the point that he is arguing is, even if my guidelines claim is not cognizable and can't be raised, I have a constitutional due process error here. And so he's trying to reframe the issue as one of due process. And you know, we can debate whether or not that due process claim is debatable, but I don't believe that the court, if it finds a substantial constitutional question, then the question, I'm changing gears here. If the court finds a substantial constitutional question, we don't think it should. In Welch, the court did consider a non-constitutional claim appended to it as well. Now, with all due respect to Your Honors and to the court, Welch didn't discuss on what authority, on what basis it was effectively exercising what I think is really pendent appellate jurisdiction. And I think the COA statute is very clear that Congress was limiting the claims that can be raised on appeal to constitutional issues. Now, it's a very interesting question of whether you can apply pendent jurisdiction, but the concern that the government has is that, again, I think it's in effect kind of going around the limitation that Congress established in the COA statute, because we're effectively reverting back to the federal rights standard. As long as there's a federal claim, even if it's not constitutional. And so I understand certainly that Welch is precedent of this court, but I would suggest that, you know, Welch is, in that respect, it doesn't explain exactly on what basis the court was able to to consider the Begay claim. But the other critical distinction is that in Welch itself, the court did find a substantial constitutional question, as Your Honor pointed out. And that's another thing that I think distinguishes this case from that case. Now, the two due process claims that Narvaez is alleging are, one is based on Tucker versus United States, the misinformation of constitutional magnitude, and one is based on Hicks versus Oklahoma. In our view, however, the problem is that he is not seeking a straightforward application of the Tucker principle or the Hicks principle, but he's actually asking the court to extend those principles. Those cases were not guidelines decisions, and they involve very different scenarios than what's present here. And as we tried to point out in our brief, Your Honors, I think that Teague versus Lane, bars the court from extending those precedents for the first time in this Section 2255 proceeding. Now, Tucker was a case where the sentencing court gave the statutory, it was a pre-guidelines case, where the court gave the statutory maximum sentence provided by law because the defendant had a number of prior felony convictions. But unbeknownst to the sentencing court, a number of those convictions were uncounseled in violation of Gideon versus Wainwright. And the Supreme Court held that to fashion a sentence based on misinformation of constitutional magnitude is a violation of due process. Neither of those prerequisites is present in this case. What we're not talking here, I don't think, about really misinformation in the sense of a factual discrepancy or some dispute. It's purely a legal classification error. Was the prior crime a crime of violence or was it not? That is not really misinformation, I think, as Tucker understood it, and certainly as Adonizio understood it afterwards. But I think the more salient point, too, is that there doesn't appear to be any dispute from Mr. Narvaez that the misinformation here, even if legal classification error is misinformation, that it is of constitutional dimension. His whole argument is that it doesn't have to be, that Tucker just extends to misinformation, whether it's of constitutional dimension or not. And I respectfully submit that that's based on a very expansive reading, and it's based on an incorrect reading of both Tucker and Adonizio. And there are also numerous cases from this court, including the 1994 en banc decision in Del Vecchio, that make clear that the misinformation must indeed be of constitutional magnitude.
Well, didn't Hicks involve a legal error having to do with a repeater statute?
Yeah, Hicks is a different issue. You don't have to have the legal versus factual misinformation is relevant to Tucker. The Hicks issue was what I guess we've termed the erroneous deprivation of the sentencer's discretion because there was a 40-year mandatory minimum imposed under a recidivist statute that was later invalidated in state court.
Why isn't that fairly analogous to what we've got here?
Because we're not dealing with a statutory mandatory minimum sentence. We're dealing with the federal sentencing guidelines. And even when the guidelines were mandatory, I don't think there's any precedent for the proposition that the guidelines were viewed as statutory minimum sentences. And in fact, in the Rodriguez decision from 2008, Justice Alito made the point that even when the guidelines were mandatory, the top end of the guidelines range was never viewed as a statutory maximum sentence. And I think by analogy to Rodriguez, it suggests that the bottom end of the guidelines ranges ought not to be viewed. Certainly, they're not statutes to begin with. I mean, the guidelines are not statutes in the sense that Hicks involved a statute duly passed by the state legislature. But they're also not really mandatory minima in the sense that that Hicks involved it. And so it may well be, for example, that the Hicks principle should be extended, but the problem that we're dealing with here is this is collateral review, and there's a Teague problem. And unless it's dictated by existing precedent, then the court would be announcing a new procedural rule for the first time in this proceeding.
Right, but that's the merits argument, not the COA argument.
No, well, with respect, I think it's both. I think that if there is for example, if the court were to conclude that our Teague argument is correct and that all reasonable jurists would conclude that this would require the court to announce a new procedural rule, then it's clear that no COA should issue in the first place. That's the import of Young, and this court has numerous precedents that say even if the underlying constitutional claim is debatable, and we don't concede that either of the claims are, if there is a plain procedural bar, then no certificate should issue in the first place. So, in other words, the point is the court often talks about it in terms of timeliness. If it's clear to all reasonable judges that a 2255 motion is time-barred, then it doesn't matter whether the underlying constitutional claim is debatable because the prisoner would not be entitled to relief in any event. And that's the analogy that we're making here. I think the Teague bar is clear because no precedent dictates the conclusion that Mr. Narvaez is asking the court to reach. And there is no dispute in this case that the rules are procedural, by the way, for Teague purposes. The only question is whether or not they're dictated by precedent. And again, I don't believe that they are. Just very briefly, a couple of other points. On the issue of Johnson, with all due respect, Judge Sykes, I don't believe that the Johnson decision, the dicta, is persuasive. I think it's I think the court is actually, if you look carefully, they're citing all their prior ACCA cases. And as the court, I hope, is aware from our brief, the ACCA cases are a special category of cases. You do have sentences that are above the maximum. And those raise very serious and very grave separation of powers concerns because we can't have individuals being sentenced beyond the maximum term that Congress who has to set the punishment for the crime, has authorized them to. So the government has not been contesting entitlements to relief in ACCA cases, but this, of course, is not an ACCA case. And what the Supreme Court, as Your Honor pointed out, all the Supreme Court said in Johnson was that it was untimely. There was no cognizability holding. And that's why, just to revert to the ultimate question, assuming that the court were to have occasion to reach the question of cognizability, I think that basically I don't have much to add beyond what's in our brief, except to say that Scott made it clear, yes, Scott involved calculation of criminal history. It wasn't a career offender case. But ultimately, Scott's conclusion, yes, it reserved a window of possibility that perhaps there could be some extraordinary case that would qualify as a miscarriage of justice or would be inconsistent with the rudimentary demands of fair procedure, but I don't believe that any kind of guidelines claim can meet that standard. Certainly, Scott didn't think so at the time the guidelines were mandatory, and I think now that the fact that the guidelines are advisory, it really pulls the rug out from under any suggestion that there's a fundamental injustice. If the defendant remains legally eligible to receive the identical sentence that he got, in fact, under this court's precedence and the uniform, I believe it's the uniform view of other circuits, he could even get a lengthier sentence today than he could have gotten back then. And so if he's legally eligible, if the sentence that he got of 170 months is still on the table, it's very difficult in my mind, at least conceptually, to see how we can say it may be there was certainly an error, but there are gradations, and there's a big gap, I think, as Scott pointed out, between an error and something that's so intolerable that it rises to the level of being a miscarriage of justice.
I get the impression that the Department of Justice is concerned about floodgates.
Yes.
Here.
Well,
is
certainly.
That fair?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's a policy-based argument. But, yes, I think if the court is going to retreat from what I would see as a retreat from the Scott rule, which has been the law of the circuit for almost 20 years, I think, yes, that there are a lot of not just career offender cases that I think it would open up the floodgates to, but I think there are a lot of any other guidelines error. I think now we would have prisoners coming back out of the woodwork saying, you know, I had a miscalculation of a two-level guidelines enhancement or a four-level role in the offense. Enhancements which, by the way, can dramatically affect what the guidelines range was. It's not just career offender errors. Yes, they can have significant impacts on the guidelines range, but other kinds of errors can as well. And I am concerned about, I mean, that's why we fought that's why we fought to seek rehearing en banc in the Gilbert case in the 11th Circuit, and that's why we fought in Sunbear to seek rehearing en banc in a case that is very similar to this one, a 2255. We are very concerned about, not necessarily, you know, it's not ultimately a question of the merits, it's a question of the burdens as well. I mean, there are, I don't know how many tens of thousands of people who were sentenced under mandatory guidelines regimes. Many of them will come forward, and if there's a cognizability holding here, and say, you know, I was erroneously sentenced and got this two-level adjustment or that career offender enhancement or this one. And the burdens, I think, are very substantial. And so the department has taken a position. We do have the concerns that Your Honor expressed. But at the same time, I think that the department's approach has been measured because, as I said earlier, in the ACCA cases, we have acknowledged that those are a special class, and we, you know, the department's mission is to do justice. It's not always to do what we think is right. It's to do justice. In our conceptualization of how that works, we believe that the ACCA cases are special and that they deserve to be carved out. But the career offender cases, you know, ultimately it's a guidelines error.
You referred to the Scott rule, and that terminology may be overstating the case a little bit because it did reserve some hedge room for some guidelines miscalculations to constitute a fundamental miscarriage of justice. So,
okay,
I mean, it's a
rule
the
general
light,
Scott,
maybe.
The general, yes, the rule light or the diet rule or the general rule, if you will, I think, of Scott. I agree. I mean, it struck me when I was preparing for the argument that in some ways it resembles the kind of watershed exception for Teague, where the Supreme Court has held out this possibility that there might be some kind of special rule that we've never discovered. I mean, it's sort of holding open an exception, even though to date we've not found anything that can kind of fit into that exception. So I see that my time is up. I don't want to prolong it. If the Court has no further questions, we would submit.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors. How much time?
I think you'd better backtrack and address the COA issue.
I will do just that. So as far as the certificate of appealability goes, we believe the case law in this circuit is quite well developed at this point and has adopted a practical approach to dealing with these cases. 2253 does contain a component requiring a substantial constitutional question, but cases in this circuit like Young and Bowie and Ramuno say that if a party like the government looks at the COA and believes that it's inadequate, it can do what it did here and file a motion to dismiss. And once that's done, the circuit will reserve judgment, allow the petitioner the opportunity to brief the constitutional issues, which we've done here in raising our due process arguments. And if that's adequately done, then there's no need to revisit the certificate because, again, it's just a gating. It serves a gating function. If, on the other hand, that we had not, like the petitioner Muno, or could not identify constitutional issues, then the court could have dismissed the appeal. But we think in this case, since we've identified the constitutional issues, it's appropriate to proceed on the merits rather than revisit the certificate. And at this point, if the court wished to revisit the certificate, it could easily amend the certificate to say including Narvaez's due process claims. But since we're already here talking about the merits, that would seem to be a waste of everybody's time. And as far as the interplay between 2253 and 2255, it's clear from our reading of the statute and from this court's opinion in Young and the Supreme Court in Miller-El that the purpose of 2253 is to serve a gatekeeping function. But once you're through the gate, this circuit can read 2255 in the exact same way as the district court can read 2255, and indeed that's consistent with the canon of constitutional avoidance. So turning to the constitutional issues that we've raised themselves since counsel addressed them, in short, we just think that their Teague arguments are entirely too rigid in this case. Hicks appears to us to be on all fours. I mean, just because it's not a sentencing guidelines case, it dealt with a state career offender. Because the sentencing guidelines had the force and effect of law, and as this court noted in its own order,
Hicks was a mandatory minimum case, though, wasn't it?
It was a mandatory minimum, but as this court noted in its order, reinstating briefing in this case at the time pre-Booker, and that's docket number 24 on the record here, before Booker, sentencing guidelines did treat the guidelines as a mandatory sentence maximum. Right? I think the exact language is treats the sentencing guidelines as a form of law equivalent to a statute setting maximum sentences.
Well, that's not the precise question, though. It's whether the mandatory guidelines and the ranges that their application produces, those binding ranges, or binding in almost all circumstances ranges, are the equivalent of the mandatory minimum that was at issue in Hicks, or at least analogous. The mandatory minimum took away all discretion. The pre-Booker mandatory guidelines didn't remove all discretion.
Maybe not all discretion, but virtually all. And in this case, we have no reason to think that it's the type of case where the court could have departed from the guidelines. Again, the court, considering all the circumstances, thought the appropriate sentence was in the midpoint of the range. And as for Tucker and its progeny just deal with sentences in general. And it doesn't make any difference, or it would be too rigid of a reading of Teague to say that rule applying to sentences should not apply to sentences as well under the guidelines. And this court in Curley and Walsh versus Lane considered similar types of sentencing mistakes. In the one case, Walsh versus Lane, it was improperly recognizing or incorrectly recognizing that the petitioner in that case had committed armed robbery rather than robbery.
How is that analogous to a predicate conviction procured by way of a Gideon violation? That's what Tucker was about, right?
It was. The constitutional issue in that case is clear. It is the Gideon violation. But in cases like Curley, when this circuit focused on what the type of legal mistake was that qualified under Tucker, in that case, it was just the amount of time that the petitioner would be serving. And in this case, that we can show that it's likely that Narvaez is serving an additional 5 years over what he would be serving absent the mistake. And finally, just to address the floodgates concern here, I'd just like to reiterate, we don't think that that's going to be a problem at all. You have a very narrow circumstance here where you have retroactively applicable Supreme Court precedent overturning what had been the clear law of the circuit. And as far as others now taking advantage of Narvaez's case, if the court credits relief here, it's going to be even a smaller subset of those cases where the petitioners sought relief within 1 year after Begay and Chambers. So unless the court has any other questions. Yes.
Thank you, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and you were appointed to represent the defendant in this case. We thank you for your vigorous efforts.
Thank you very much.